This episode is brought to you by Progressive Insurance. Whether you love true crime or comedy, celebrity interviews or news, you call the shots on what's in your podcast queue. And guess what? Now you can call them on your auto insurance too with the Name Your Price tool from Progressive. It works just the way it sounds. You tell Progressive how much you want to pay for car insurance, and they'll show you coverage options that fit your budget. Get your quote today at Progressive.com to join the over 28 million drivers who trust Progressive. Progressive Casualty Insurance Company and Affiliates. Price and coverage match limited by state law.
Joining us right now to talk all things the business of sports is our buddy John Aran, media reporter for Sports Business Journal. Hey, John.
Hey, guys. How are you?
Good morning. Good. How are you actually doing? Just kind of perusing your tweets recently, and one jumped out at me, and it just frustrates the hell out of us, but it makes some sense. The kids still watch the Pro Bowl. The Pro Bowl still had 8 million viewers, and you compared it to the best college basketball game of the year, viewer-wise, and it didn't even have half that. That was Duke UVA.
Isn't that insane? I mean, I don't personally know one person that watches the NFL Pro Bowl, but you run out on a Sunday with no other NFL games or really no other football. You run out an exhibition game, and it just brings in huge numbers. It's really incredible, and it's akin to actually the preseason. Who watches preseason NBA? Not a lot of people, but you know, preseason NFL. Some of those games, especially with Cleveland and God, why am I blanking on the quarterback's name? But they got some big numbers as well in the preseason. But
it's Baker Mayfield.
Yeah. Baker Mayfield. Thank you. I was going to say Johnny Football, but I knew it wasn't him.
Right.
But it's these NFL exhibitions. It just shows the strength of the NFL. Any other league would give their right eye really to get those kind of numbers for an exhibition.
John, do you think it's young eyeballs that are being drawn to the Pro Bowl? Because like as you mentioned, I don't know one adult that sits down and would give even 30 minutes to the Pro Bowl, let alone a couple of hours. Is it the younger demo that's watching?
You know, the crazy thing, the kids these days, they all stream, right?
Yeah.
I mean, so I can't imagine. I haven't actually dove into the demo, so I don't know. But my guess is that it's an older audience that's watching the Pro Bowl.
Because
it's really old guys that watch broadcast TV. It's not the younger kids.
Is it this love of football the reason why networks are getting involved with these spin-off leagues like the XFL and the Alliance of American Football? Because I see you've tweeted about that recently. I can't believe they're going to get network deals.
Yeah, isn't that insane? So the XFL isn't launching for another year, and you're going to be able to see their games on ABC and Fox. I mean, those aren't little deals. Those are pretty substantial deals. Are you guys going to watch Alliance next week?
Well, does it start next week? What's the schedule?
The opening game is next, I believe it's Saturday.
Wow.
And it's going to be on CBS, a broadcast network.
Gotta have names. I'm not going to watch it just because it's football.
I'll be honest,
gotta have names.
I don't even know what cities have teams. I don't know team names.
Yeah, you gotta know players. Like one reason why the USFL, now I'm dating us here, but that Herschel Walker, right? They had Gary, it's just massive names. I don't know anybody playing in the AAF.
You're gonna have guys like Trent Richardson playing.
I mean, I know the coaches.
Yeah,
but I
you know
need
the coaches.
Know the
you're probably going to know the analysts as well that are going to be doing it. They haven't announced them yet, so I'm not sure who it's going to be. But they're going to be sort of bigger names there as well. And it's just going to be football. So if you're conditioned to watch NFL Network on a Thursday night, the first Thursday night of the playoffs, re-aired a game. And it got almost 1 million viewers for a re-air. I mean, so the people are just kind of conditioned to, you know, you go to a bar and you just want to have it on, or that's not Nielsen rated. But they're trying to just get these people that are conditioned to do it.
Well, the Alliance rules are going to be interesting. They're going to try and speed this game up, right? So the play
2 hours. Yeah.
The play clock's going to be, I think they said, 30 seconds. Instead of the onside kicks, they're going to give the team the ball at their own 35 and a 4th and 10. If they convert, they get to keep the ball. No extra points. You got to go for two. So they are tweaking a lot of the rules to make it more interesting and maybe more viewer friendly. But I'm like Eric. I mean,
I need to know the players.
Well, I mean, you'll probably recognize
quarterback.
You'll recognize some of them.
You can watch Aaron Murray play for the Atlanta Legends.
But here's the deal, John. you can bet on the game, so
it might
add some more interest.
Are you really? Are you going to wager on this?
I don't know. Probably not.
All right, but yeah, so here we go, John. So we talk about this and the 8 million dummies that are watching it and how football just always draws eyeballs, and yet there's a narrative that the Super Bowl is down, and I guess statistically it is, right? It's lowest rated Super Bowl since 2007, 2008, whatever it is. And yet numbers were up this year but down for the Super Bowl. Is that a product of sort of a lack of interest from L.A., lack of interest from New Orleans, or is there something bigger at stake here?
I don't think there's anything bigger at stake yet. I think it's something that bears watching because that 100 million number, they dropped below 100 million viewers, and that was sort of a big marker. And when they passed it 10 years ago, that was a big deal. And now they dropped back below that, and that's similarly a big deal. They're trying to say that they got a lot more streaming, and they got over 100 million if you include the number of people that watch it on streams. But it's
that counts. That kind of does count.
It does count. But my point is, 98 million viewers is going to be the number one program, most watched show by far of anything on television in the United States.
By 50 million, probably.
Yeah, it's ridiculous how big that number is. So really, whether it's 105 million or 98 million,
I agree.
It's really insubstantial to me. I mean, until it gets down to like back down to 70, you know, and I don't see it going down like that. It's still a number that's just awe-inspiring, really.
The Tony Romo situation, everybody seemed to fall in love with him down the stretch. I've always liked him. I love when he's calling out the plays and kind of predicting things. He did less of that, though, in the Super Bowl. Is that sort of a product, in your estimation, of just sort of a dull game offensively? Wasn't a lot of opportunities for him to call out some big explosive plays? Or
yeah,
do you think there was something bigger there?
No, I think it was a little bit of a dull game, and I think it's for CBS, it's executives. It's less about him actually predicting plays, and it's more about, like, you know, he brings like this genuine excitement to it.
Enthusiasm.
So when he's predicting plays, he's like in there and just almost like shouting out like he's sitting next to you on a couch. And
right.
I always compare that to, like, you know, Gus Johnson, who I just think I think his excitement level is not genuine. Like, I think that a couple decades ago when he first started sort of shouting endings of games, it was, but now that's sort of what he's expected to do, so
it's
he does
shtick.
It, you know? Yeah, it's a shtick. With Tony Romo, it doesn't feel like a shtick at all to me when he does that. He feels like genuine. They're like, they got to do this, and that's sort of how the predictions come out, but it's less predictions, more enthusiasm to me.
Gotcha. All right. So, what about the Adnan Burke guy? I'll be honest with you. I wasn't a big Adnan Burke guy. I didn't know about him.
Come on.
I didn't know he's a big MLB guy. He's apparently escorted off campus there in Bristol after allegedly leaking information, maybe to awful announcing. What's your take on that whole deal?
Yeah, guys, this for me is a bigger story than the Super Bowl numbers. This is crazy. Apparently, he didn't just give information to awful announcing, because look. For what we do, all of us have sources everywhere, and they
right.
give information. He actually, the allegation is, called up some of his supervisors, asked questions that were provided to him, you know, and that by awful announcing, got the answers, turned around and asked him. Once the ESPN executives sort of figured that out, that just was a different level of passing on information that came out of a meeting. That was something that sort of really concern them. So that,
and he's going to sue now, though? Is that what he's alleging?
That's what it looks like. So it's there will be lawyers, as they say.
Because he had just signed a 4-year deal.
Well, it just sounds like he's a
big
stupid
deal.
Because if he's the only person getting that info, they're going to know exactly
right.
where it came from.
Took him 2
no
seconds
kidding.
To know that.
Yeah, I mean, if you work in this business, you have to know about that. And then also on awful announcing, Casey, you got to take care of your sources. You can't allow that guy to
right.
be out there on
like
his own.
That. Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. That's, not good.
That's unbelievable.
Not good.
All right, John.
Thank you, buddy. Appreciate it.
Hey, always love doing this. Thanks for having me, guys.
Yeah, thank you, John.
I can't
Take care.
Believe the XFL and the Alliance of American Football are getting networked. They are.
We really need new phones.
T-Mobile will cover the cost of 4 amazing new iPhone 15s, and each line is only $25 a month.
New iPhone 15s? It's better
over here. Only at T-Mobile, get 4 iPhone 15s on us and 4 lines for $25 per line per month with eligible trade-in when you switch.
Minimum of 4 lines for $25 per line per month with auto-pay discount using debit or bank account. $5 more per line without auto-pay, plus taxes and fees. Phone fee at 24 monthly bill credits for well-qualified customers. Contact us before canceling account to continue bill credits or credit stop and balance on required finance agreement due. $35 per line connection charge applies. See T-Mobile.com.
Join us right now on the Mattress Warehouse Hotline. I'm buddy Alan May, brought to you by the D.C. Lottery. Where winning never felt so good. Play the new Washington Capitals 2018 Stanley Cup champion scratcher today. And you could win $50,000 instantly. Good morning, Alan.
Hey, good morning, guys.
Hello, we spent some time earlier in the show taking some calls, kind of based on the article in the Washington Post, wondering whether Todd Reardon's the guy to press the right buttons, and Brian McClellan said, we'll see, essentially, is what he said. And a couple things in the article that were pointed out, and you can talk about this, is he at least tried to shake things up by benching Cousy the other night after a bad penalty.
Well, you know what? I thought it was the worst part of that penalty was the call. I thought it was a non-call. It was Mike Bilbrey on the NBC broadcast. So, you know, you have to leave yourself a little leeway when you make threats against the players, because I thought both of the original penalties by Yashin and Kuznetsov, which sat them on the bench, I think Kuznetsov played 3 minutes and 21 seconds that game, coming off what I thought was his best game of the season, and we've been dying for him to get going, and it looks like he came out of the break flying, and then he gets benched there, takes momentum out of the team. So, you know, I like the discipline part of it, but there's a cause and effect to, you know, why they're taking these stick penalties. And it's, you know, those two guys were the culprits the other night. What's he going to do tonight if that happens first shift to Ovechkin and then the next shift to Backstrom? Those are your two best players every single night this season, the two most consistent players. So you've got to be careful. It probably should have been done at the 30-game mark, because to wait to the 52-game, stretch of the season, it's kind of tough because it's already become an epidemic. So they definitely aren't playing the right way. That's why they're getting the penalties. It's more than just discipline. They're not doing the right things on the ice as a team.
Alan, what's going on with the penalty kill percentage right now? Right around 78%, 24th in the NHL.
Well, I think the biggest thing with what's going on with the power play and the penalty kill especially, is that they're giving up way too many chances. And they just don't have the right mix of guys. They're not getting the big face-off wins in a consistent basis on the penalty kill. And then they're not getting the clear. So I think they're just taxing the players too much. And don't forget, you had the entire season, you almost had Brooks Orpik not out there. And he blocked so many shots. He's got the geometry of how to be a great penalty killer down. But I think the slot coverage in that area, in that hash mark in front of the net, that seems to be the biggest problem that they have. So, you know, it's not having the right personnel. And then the other side of it was, you know, they're not doing the right things on the penalty kill as far as protecting the slot. And when worst comes to worst, you always just crowd the house. You're not crowding the house enough.
So is the criticism for Todd Reardon, is it warranted? Or do you put more of this, you know, this streak of 8 out of 9 losses on the players?
No. I'll say it's warranted on Todd. But a young coach is a little different making the decision when you're the top guy. Just like us, you know, you guys in the media, me as analysts, it's easy to make all the decisions when you're sitting there, you know, 300 feet up in the press box. But you look at, you know, what he's done. He's waited too long to discipline players, and that's a learning lesson. Do I think he's a great coach still? Yeah, I do. But you know what? He waited a little long, was a little too patient. And now he's got to show some tough love to the team. I thought tough love should have been shown to the players that were playing very poorly. And Kuznetsov was a guy that was absent for a long stretch for the Caps, and we weren't getting anywhere close to an A or a B level performance out of him. He is, in my opinion, and most people's opinion, a follow the game, one of the top 10 most talented players in the league. And I think he should be near the top of the league in scoring. He should be able to get 2 points a night. He should have not just 10 or 11 goals, he should be up close to 20, 25 already. He let that go on. Kuznetsov did what he could the first game back against Calgary. I loved his performance. He wanted the puck every shift. TJ Oshie has not been playing properly, and he continues to get the big-time ice time out there. He goes out anytime that anything's in doubt. TJ Oshie's on the ice. And, you know, TJ can play a lot better than he's been playing. There's been a lot of giveaways with the puck, a lot of overhandling of the puck. Lars Eller not making anywhere near the right decisions with the puck. And these are really good hockey players that are on the ice all the time. And I think he let that part go. So I expect him, you know, the discipline with the penalties, that's one thing. He's got to be disciplined with overall play when it comes to the coach, making sure that he's taking ice and forcing guys to do better. And then, you look at a couple of the players like Matt Niskanen and Dmitry Orlov. These guys, it was so safe when you saw them go on the ice late last season. You thought, oh, all right, they're going to shut down the other team's top guys. They're not the top players. They always mention that in the print around here, that they're the Caps top two defensemen. They're not. They're the top shutdown pair. John Carlson is the top defenseman on the team. So whenever he's on the ice, the top guy, whoever he's played with, that's the top pair. But I saw Niskanen and Orlov. Collectively, I thought it was Matt. I've watched Matt a long time because I was in Dallas forever. He played there forever. Every play he made at the puck the other night was the wrong play. And that's, normally he's a simple guy. Orlov had a really tough game the other night. Those two guys paired together were a disaster against the Bruins. And you look at them, I couldn't figure what the hell was going on because they're such good players. They normally make the right play every single time. And it was like they were making the wrong pass every single time. So, the losing's definitely in their head. It's definitely affected them. But I think Todd, he just continues to roll some of those guys. And I think tough love with ice time more than penalties is, to me, tough love on how guys are playing is more important than who's taking a penalty.
Alan, you mentioned Brooks Orpik earlier. I'm not trying to set you off. I know you're a big Brooks Orpik guy. But how do you explain the stat where they're 19-8-1 without him, but 9-10-5 with him? Is that just sort of a fluky thing?
Absolutely. It's just like one of those things where Jay Beagle scores a goal, the Caps are, they're undefeated, and then you score a goal in the playoff game and he doesn't win. So, things like that, you can manipulate them all you want. Don't forget, they won a Stanley Cup with Brooks Orpik in the lineup, and their record with Brooks Orpik in the lineup the last few years, they got a couple hundred wins, and it's drastically in his favor. So what's going on right now has nothing to do with Brooks Orpik. This was happening. They were dying on the vine before he got back. And I think they're a better team with them in the lineup. They've got to get their act together. So to blame a third-pairing defenseman for their woes right now is absolutely wrong.
Joined by Alan May, who's brought to you by the D.C. Lottery, where winning never felt so good. Play the new Washington Capitals 2018 Stanley Cup champion Scratcher today, and you can win $50,000 instantly. Got to feel good for Copley. Signs a three-year deal. Talk about his play this year and the three-year deal.
Well, I think he surprised everyone, and he continues to come out and play very well, although the last few stretches he's had in net haven't been very good. But then again, I don't think any goaltender in the league would be playing as good the way the Caps were playing in front of him. I think it's absolutely perfect that the way he's come back, they brought him back after that trade with Troy Brouwer to St. Louis to get TJ Oshie. And I didn't think he'd be this good. I think he surprised me. He surprised everyone around the National Hockey League. He gives them a chance every time he's in there. And, the backup goaltender, it's important to have a guy that you're not scared of and, worried every time he's in net, you're rolling your eyes, here we go again, because that hasn't been the case with him. And, he bounced back. He's shown some strength because at the start of the year, he got absolutely pounded in his first start, 6-0 by the New Jersey Devils. And he went back out and just found a way to rack up wins, to give his team confidence. So I'm happy that he was able to get that contract. They didn't break the bank to do it, but he's got some security, and he deserves it.
Joined by Alan May, brought to you by the D.C. Lottery, where winning never felt so good. Play the new Washington Capitals 2018 Stanley Cup champion Scratcher today. You could win $50,000 instantly. So Copley gets a three-year extension. Samsonov is being groomed in Hershey at this point. Holtby is signed through the end of next season. What is it going to look like in a few seasons when Holtby's a UFA and you've got these two young goalies not making a lot of money? Holtby's going to want to make more than what he's making at this point. I believe he's making like $5 million per season at this point. So is it going to be the two young guys going forward after next season? I know it's looking down the road a bit.
Well, the thing with Braden is he going to want to play somewhere else? Is he going to want to chase dollars? Are the dollars going to be there with other teams at his age at the time? His numbers have gone up this year. I still think he's a phenomenal goaltender. He hasn't been treated very well by his team defensively this season. But you know what? Those things are the reason they sign these guys as well, is to have players exposed for the expansion draft. Seattle comes in the 21 season, and that's part of what the Phoenix Top League contract's about, dangling people out there. You might have Vitek Vanacek and Samsonov. Vitek Vanacek was an American League All-Star at the American League All-Star game just a couple of weeks ago. So he's obviously acclimated to playing in North America. So you never know with this. I think as long as Braden Holtby wants to be a Washington Capital, he's a Washington Capital. And you know what? He's done too much here. He's played too well. you can't just give the net away. Those players, you know, Samsonov has struggled at times this year, so you can't just say because he was drafted in the first round and, you know, he's a top prospect for them that he's going to be a legitimate NHL player. So, you know, only time will tell how he handles the bus rides in the American Hockey League, how he handles a team that's not scoring goals for him, and he's going to have to be the guy to keep them in every game. You know, he struggled mightily at the start of the year. He's just starting to come around now. So it's way too far ahead in the crystal ball to even guess who would be the goaltenders for the Caps at that time.
All right, so I'm looking at this game tonight, and, you know, we kind of threw around the phrase a must-win game earlier in the day. I know it's not truly a must-win. This team's still, you know, only a couple points out of the Metro lead, or 4 points out of the Metro lead. But they're in a stretch of their schedule, Alan. Vancouver tonight, Colorado home, Florida home, L.A. home, right? Four very winnable games. Vancouver played last night, lost 2-1 in Philly. Apparently, Markstrom's going to play in goal again tonight. But this is one of those games where you kind of say to yourself, you got to win. So talk to me about Vancouver, and do you feel good about tonight?
Well, Vancouver is one of those teams that plays, you know, they play a fast-paced game. They've got a lot of young players. They make big mistakes. They keep you in the game, and they keep themselves in the game. I think if the Capitals play the way that they played Friday night, with so much speed and determination on defense, and then turn that into offensive opportunities, I think they can wipe the Canucks out. The Canucks' defense isn't very good, in my opinion, but the Caps haven't been great at forechecking this year. They haven't been great on the hit parade and dominating inside the offensive zone. But I think if you have Kuznetsov and Backstrom going as good as they can tonight, there's no way that the Caps should lose the game. I think Kuznetsov himself can steal games, and if he can carry on what he had Friday night against Calgary, he's going to be unstoppable by the Vancouver key. And I think the Caps realize, after so many players looking so bad against the Boston Bruins the other day, and then everything about that game, the fact it was only 1-0 showed how great Braden Holtby played, because it should have been 7 or 8-0. The Caps got outplayed that bad. Their puck decisions were awful. I don't think they can play that bad 2 games in a row. I expect everyone to have a gut check and to come out with so much more intensity, so much more speed and determination, that they're going to make sure that they win that game, just like they won the game against Calgary without Ovechkin.
All right, so you like them tonight. All right.
Great stuff. Thank you, Alan. Appreciate it.
All right. Take care, guys.
All right, take care,
we'll
buddy.
Talk to you again soon.
That was Alan May, brought to you by the D.C. Lottery, where winning never felt so good. Play the new Washington Capitals 2018 Stanley Cup champion scratcher today. You could win $50,000 instantly. Now joined on the Mattress Warehouse hotline by longtime friend of the show, Sage Rosenfels, former Skins and other teams in the NFL quarterback. Believe he had stints with the Texans, Vikings, Dolphins.
See, this was the closest walk-up song we could come to Sage Rosenfels. It's Rosanna. Rosenfels, okay. Rosanna.
Is that the theme?
So that's going to be your walk-up song.
I like
song
it.
Just work with us there, Sage.
Hey, now, you have a Jew-ish Super Bowl MVP, so you got to throw a little respect to the Rosens.
That's right.
Over
that's
here. And I did play also for the NFC East rival New York Football Giants.
That's correct. I left them out. My apologies. True.
What is the all-time Jewish team in the NFL? What does it look like?
Well, it's the smartest team in the NFL. It's the most handsome team in the NFL. That's what it looks like.
Right.
Are they the most athletic? Probably not.
But who does it include?
Yeah, who's on the Mount Rushmore?
Yeah, give us some players that are on it.
Well, interesting enough, Mike Rosenthal, who went to Notre Dame, of course, a great school for a lot of Jewish athletes, right. Is Notre Dame. Jay Fiedler.
Who's
good? You know, obviously, Julian Edelman, who says he's sort of like me, Jewish, sort of Jewish,
uh-huh.
Jewish when it's convenient. Sid Gilman, I think, was some players back in the old days. When I was a rookie, actually, with the Skins, I get a letter in the mail that says that I'm inducted into the National Jewish Sports Hall of Fame. And when there was 9 other players that year that were in the NFL that were Jewish, and I think Josh Miller was a punter for the Steelers at the time. I don't recall all the other players' names. We have Mike Rosenthal.
Would Josh Rosen be the backup quarterback to Fiedler?
No, that's me. Are you kidding me?
Oh.
He's still a young guy. He's third string. Okay.
All right. So Sage and then Josh Rosen. I see here Lyle Alzado was Jewish. Didn't know that.
Oh, there you go. There you go. So, yeah, maybe I should do some research and come up with an all-Jewish team. I probably only could go through the single deep, so then other than quarterback.
Huh. You are on the list here on ranker.com.
Nice.
All-time Jewish NFL roster. They got you right behind John Frank, who played for the 49ers, and right ahead of Jeff Schwartz, who played guard for the Giants.
Nice.
Yeah, Jeff Schwartz, you see him a lot. You know, he's on Twitter, and he's all over the NFL covering the league. So he and I were teammates with the Giants, and we actually talked about our Jewish ancestry. And I was actually just in Miami speaking at FIU talking about ancestry, and I'm half Jewish. My dad's Jewish. My mom was not. And you know, what all that means, you know, and heritage and things like that. So it always meant a lot to me that I was a little bit different, obviously, coming from a small town in Iowa. And different, you go to college and in the locker room, there's no more Jewish guys at Iowa State, and got into other NFL locker rooms. And I believe Jay Fiedler was the only other Jewish player I played with, oh, I guess, other than Jeff Schwartz.
Right.
Well, I don't know what ethnicity, what religion Jared Goff is, but he's taken a lot of culpability for the loss in the Super Bowl. What do you make of the young quarterback in that game? It almost looked like, to me, when they would show the replays, it's hard to tell, that his receivers weren't open.
Yeah, there weren't a lot of guys open. I tell you, the Patriots, and I'm actually going to go back and watch that game this morning. The NFL Game Pass comes out usually late Monday night or Tuesday morning, where for me as a player, as a former player, I can go back and I can actually see how the coaches see the film. You know, you get the more of the bird's eye view. You can see how all the coverages are set up. But from what I could tell on TV, and the Patriots played almost all man coverage throughout the season. Obviously Gilmore, one of the better cover corners in the league. They let Patrick Chung, a very good coverage safety. And then in this game, they played a ton of zone. They were not going to match up speed for speed with guys like Brandon Cooks. They just weren't going to do that. They were going to play a lot of zone coverage, force their front seven to stop the run, which they did a very good job of, and force Jared Goff, who, you know, they love the play action there with the L.A. Rams, force him to drop back after that play action and try to find the holes in the defense as his receivers are sort of running through those zones. And you have to be have great timing and real precision to find those open spots. And so, yeah, the Patriots did a lot of different things in that ball game, played a various amount of coverages. They rushed five a ton, but then also played zone behind it, which you don't see that a lot. A lot of times you see a rush five and you see man behind it, and they played zone. So, you know, I think that a couple things went awry in that game for the Rams. And as I was sort of – they were replaying it yesterday at NFL Network. They were continually trying to push the ball down the field. Double moves, deep post or deep corner routes, post routes. And I think that was the wrong plan against that type of coverage. They really should have gone to the sort of the dink and dunk type of offense, and maybe spread them out. That's what the Patriots did in that final drive: spread them out, dink and dunk, work your way down the field, possess the football, and not take those shots. But that's sort of who the Rams were all year: run the ball, play action, and take shots down the field. And they continued to try to do that as the game went on, and they just didn't have time in the pocket. A lot of twists and stunt games by the New England Patriots caused Jared Goff to get a lot of pressure. You know, I think he was sacked four times and looked like he was hit five or six other times in the game.
Yeah, Sage, I want to get your take on a couple things. First of all, when we talked about this, and everyone's talking about it, why McVay didn't use Gurley more, all right? And I know that Gurley was banged up towards the end of the year, but he had 100 yards plus in the Cowboy game, in that playoff game. They didn't use him in the Saint game and didn't go to him in this game for whatever reason. He says he was healthy. He looked like he had some burst, especially in the second half. But for whatever reason, McVay didn't go to him, and that really crushed their play-action game, as you mentioned. And then number two, why didn't McVay make the adjustments? You would think that, you know, this guy is an offensive genius. He would have seen something. You just talked about the zones that he was seeing. Why didn't he make any adjustments? So start with Gurley and then talk about the lack of adjustments from McVay offensively.
Well, you know, with Gurley, and again, I was sort of watching that game yesterday, and there was a spot in the fourth quarter. The game still tied 3-3. The Rams have the ball near midfield, and Gurley rips off about a 13-14 yard run. It's called back for holding.
Right.
And that sort of, and then next thing you know, they're in second 22, and they, you know, they end up punting, and, you know, I think the Patriots got the ball and boom, moved down and got their touchdown. And so, you know, the thing with running the football is that you have to continually get first downs to do that. You know, if you're punting and going three and out all the time, it's hard to go, okay, we've gone three and out six times in a row. We're going to continue to try to, you know, just hand the ball to our running back and get first downs. You get sort of anxious and you want to throw the ball and you sort of want to, you know, get the ball rolling a little bit and get those first downs. And so I think he just sort of naturally, it's almost a mind thing to just sort of like naturally go away from the run. And he did it in this ball game. So I think that was, you know, that was a mistake. Sean McVay did not have his best coaching performance. He admitted that after the game. He can coach a lot better. I mean, it's his first Super Bowl. He's going against Belichick, and you know, early on in that game, you start seeing things that are different than you've been preparing for, you know, all year long. Your quarterback's getting a ton of pressure every time he drops back. It seemed like he was getting harassed. You know, I don't know what the situation is with Gurley's health. Obviously, that's sort of a big mystery, and I don't think anyone's ever going to know that. But yeah, obviously, I think Sean McVay, if he would have gone back and could replay that game, he would have handed the ball to Gurley, you know, 10 more times. There was some stat going into the game if Gurley had, you know, something like 18 carries, and, you know, basically the Rams were going to win the football game. And only, I think he only had 11 in that game the other night. So, you know, that was a big mistake. And yeah, another thing was I would think that, you know, he was getting anxious when you're sitting on, you know, 3 points, you know, throughout the ball game, and you're so used to scoring. You're so used to putting up, you know, 30, 35, 40 points week in and week out. I think you get a little bit anxious and you want to be aggressive. You want to, you know, score right away. And again, he was continuing to try to throw the ball down the field and more low percentage passes. Also where Jared Goff had to hold on to the football. I'd like to think if Sean McVay could redo the passing game part of the game, he'd go empty. He'd get the ball out. He'd throw my wide receiver screens. He'd, you know, dink and dunk with stick routes by the tight end and work little option routes on the inside and just slowly, methodically, you know, work his way down the field. Yeah, obviously one of his probably worst called games of the year, something he's going to have to learn from. And but I don't think it means Sean McVay's a bad coach. I don't think it means Jared Goff's a bad quarterback. Goff put up, he had a, you know, pretty dang good year. He's a young guy, third year in the league. You know, after his rookie, everyone thought he was going to be a terrible quarterback. And next thing you know, he's actually pretty good. We don't know how good he's going to be. He had way too much pressure in that ball game. To really understand, you know, if Jared Goff is a really great quarterback or just a good quarterback. But I think he's got a bright future. I think Sean McVay's got a bright future. They both had bad games against Bill Belichick, which is not the first time that's ever happened to a quarterback and to an offensive coach.
Hey, real quick, Sage, we were debating Kyler Murray here recently. Just kind of your take on the Heisman Trophy winner if he chooses to play football.
Well, I actually called for Touchdown Radio Network this year. I called the Oklahoma-Kansas State game, and man, was I impressed! I was so impressed by Murray's, his athleticism. He maybe has the quickest feet of any quarterback I've ever seen. He's not the fastest. I came out with Michael Vick in 2001. He's the fastest quarterback that I've ever seen, but he's very quick. He's got a very strong arm, very good arm. He can flick it, you know, 50 yards. He's very accurate. The one thing I noticed in that game was he was standing back there for, you know, 3, 4, 5 hitches. The Oklahoma offensive line is one of the best pass blocking offensive lines in college football. That's not really realistic in the NFL. We all know how good defensive linemen are, you know, to get to the quarterback. So my thing is he's just so small. I don't mind quarterbacks that are, you know, I like quarterbacks that are, you know, elusive and they can create and buy time and do those types of things that Kyler Murray does, but he is just so small. And the question is, you know, I mean, he's like Doug Flutie, it seems like, minus, you know, 15 pounds. And Flutie was known to be a really small guy. You know, Russell Wilson, yeah, he's short, but, man, he's really thick, all right?
Right.
I mean, I don't know how he's very stocky, you know, and that allows you to play for a long time. So when you draft a quarterback in the first round or the second round, you're hoping he's the guy not for, you know, 6 years or 7 years like a running back. You know, you're hoping he's the guy for the next 15 years. That's what you're looking for. And, you know, that's the question with, like, you know, Lamar Jackson. You know, can he have that style, more of a running quarterback right now because he's not a great thrower? Can he do that for 15 years? Probably not. He's going to get beat up if he, you know, plays that way. You got to be a great thrower. Kyler Murray is a very good thrower, but he is also very, very small. So in my opinion, I think he's using this whole football thing to try to get as much money out of baseball as possible. And if you compare the two sports, all the different variables, you know, baseball has guaranteed contracts. You can play for a long, long time, way less stress and anxiety that playing quarterback, has in the NFL. I think this is what his whole strategy is flirt with the NFL as much as possible, right to the brink. So baseball brings up their number from whatever it is, $4.5 million, which is what he's got right now, to something like $15 million. They can figure out a way to do that. I do think that's his actual plan. If he was an NFL quarterback, and I'd be concerned about his size for long-term durability.
All right, Sage, appreciate the insight. That's Sage Rosenfels. You can check him out, The Athletic Minnesota. Thanks, pal.
Thanks, buddy.
All right, guys, thanks for having me on.
Yep. Chris Miller covers the Wizards for NBC Sports Washington, and keep waiting for this team to turn the corner, and it's not happening. It's got to be frustrating, Chris, covering this team and interviewing the guys after these games.
Good morning, guys. Yeah, last night was another one of those head-scratchers, and many of head-scratchers this year. You think that they would have learned their lesson after that Cavs game. But to come out and play like that, giving up 23s to the Atlanta Hawks last night and having Vince Carter kind of turn the clock back on us was disappointing. But it's been the narrative really all year long when they've had really good stretches. But here of late, you know, I think they're going back to some of the bad habits defensively.
Chris, I think Scott Brooks could maybe live with, I don't know, three or four Hawks, maybe five, getting into double figures. But to have nine players from the Hawks reach double figures on your home floor, I'm sorry, it's just an embarrassing loss. It's embarrassing. It's ugly.
Yeah, this is probably one of the tougher ones. It's hard to rank them because, you know, that Cavs game was really disappointing. But, yeah, this is up there. You know, for Trae Young, who is, you know, the future. I mean, the kid had a poor shooting night, and he still had a double-double. I think he had 10 and 10.
Yep.
Again, Torian Prince had 21. I mean, John Collins had 15 and 11. He didn't even play in the second half because he got a laceration to his face. So the only reason why Vince Carter had the night that he had was because of, you know, Collins getting injured towards the end of that second quarter.
Well, then you ask yourself, all right, well, something needs to change. What can change? What can this team do? You know, they're saddled with some huge contracts with an injured player like John. You know, it's just frustrating to come in here and talk about them losing to teams like Atlanta and Cleveland, right? I mean, we going into the game, we go, all right, well, you got to beat Atlanta. I mean, they're below you in the standings. They're terrible on the road. They were 9-22 on the road before the game, but you give up 140 to them. But something's got to change. I don't think it's as simple as just saying, all right, Scotty's not the man. I don't believe that's the case. There's something with the personnel that's just not right. What can this team do?
Well, they're stuck. Obviously, we know the financial commitments that have been made to their big three of Wall, Beal, and Porter. But I think the bigger picture is, as awful as the season started, they've been dealing with injuries really all year long. And it's not an excuse, but it's the reality when – the big guy in the middle was supposed to be here day one. He wasn't even available day one. It ended up being a back surgery. Not sure when Dwight's going to come back, if he comes back this year. You got Markieff Morris, who has been out of the lineup. I think the two guys that, besides Bradley Beal, obviously, the other two MVPs this year would be Jeff Green and Trevor Ariza. And unfortunately, with the trade deadline coming Thursday, they might be your most valuable assets to make a move. But my question then would be, well, why the hell would you move them? They've actually been the most consistent veterans that we've had besides Beal this year. So they're in a tough situation. To me, I say just keep it the way it is and just ride out this season and then do whatever you got to do in the summer, because it just doesn't make any sense to me to make a move just to make a move. I know people on Twitter got at me last week for saying that, but I don't feel like making like a small move is going to make this team any better. I'll tell you what you do have that's been a fine. Hey, guys, Jordan McRae is a professional scorer.
Yep.
And this could be something that could be a move, tear up that two-way deal and give him a little more money that can help the Wizards down the stretch of the season. Because, guys, he is a bucket. When the Wizards were down 15 last night, Scott Brooks had to put him in, and there was instant offense, there was instant flow on that side of the floor.
I know that Ted and Bradley said that they have no intentions of doing this. But what's the point of keeping Ariza and Otto if you think you can trade him and Green? I say go into a mini tank mode. I really do. There's no point. They're not going to go to the playoffs, and if they do, they'll be the eighth seed and get boat raced in the first round. There's just no point in that. So I would say do a slightly different version of a tankathon the rest of the year. Try and improve your positions in the draft. You're getting rid of guys who are going to be free agents anyway. I don't understand just staying pat with what they have. Doesn't make sense to me.
I thought it was interesting. I talked to Brad last week. It's on our Wizards Talk podcast, which you can download and hear it. He said that the Wizards are going to make the playoffs, period. Said it with so much conviction that he had me believing it. And I think what many people forget is making the playoffs is still making the playoffs. And remember, guys, this is a double bottom line business. There's the money aspect of it. The Wizards will be making money making the playoffs. Okay, not making the playoffs, you don't get the playoff money, right? So, in theory, when you're talking about a mini tank, that means not making the playoffs. And that's
I don't know if they're good enough to make the playoffs.
You know what? Time is winding down. You're right. You're right.
Not when you're the second worst defense in the league. Come on.
But there's some bad teams in the East also, and the problem is they're getting beat by those bad teams, and that's what's hurting them. But still. Again, I wouldn't make a move just to make a move. It doesn't make sense to me. If you're still trying to win, and I'm sorry, that word gets on my nerves. When I hear tanking, it's such a negative connotation to it.
I love it.
And if you've ever competed in anything in your life, anything, I don't care if it's cards or whatever. You never go into it going, well, I'll play better. I'll have a better hand in about five or six more hands. Okay, you don't do that. You go in thinking, I'm going to win this card game, or you're playing pickup with the 50-year-olds at the Y. Nobody, this whole thought of just quitting, that's basically what it is. It's another word for quitting. And the guys in that room aren't going to do it. No. I can tell you that much. Those guys are trying to get a check, especially those guys that are on those one-year deals.
Of course.
They're not going to sit there and try to lose just for the sake of trying to help the organization get better standing to get a better draft pick. That's just not going to happen.
Well, I'm not saying the players would never tank. GMs and coaches tank, and that's what I'm saying. They could put their team in a better position to lose games and play guys like Jordan McRae more often. You know what I mean? I don't know.
I think you have a chance of winning with Jordan McRae, to be honest with you.
Well, play him more then. Play him more.
Real quick, we talked earlier about James Harden. You cover the NBA. You watch all things. Can you believe what he's doing?
No, because he is a dynamic offensive force, and I have to be careful how I say this because I don't want you guys to take this the wrong way. There are nights where he gets away with stuff on the floor where I'm like, whoa, these side dribbles, the sliding of the foot after you've taken two steps, he's getting to the free throw line. I mean,
bars.
He's almost like the quarterback in practice that has the red jersey on. I feel like that's him in an actual NBA game at times. Mm. But I can't take anything away from the way the guy gets buckets. It's historic, actually, to see just some of the stuff he can do on that end.
Yeah, right. He definitely gets away with a lot. All right, thanks, Chris.
Thank you, Chris. Appreciate
it. Good talking to you.
Yep. All right, take care, buddy.
T-Mobile has invested billions to light up America's largest 5G network from big cities to small towns, including right here in yours. And great coverage is just the beginning. Right now, families and small businesses can save up to 20% versus AT&T and Verizon when they switch. Visit your local T-Mobile store today.
Plan savings with three lines of T-Mobile Essentials versus comparable available plans. Plan features and taxes and fees may vary.